Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, blue chips gone bad, catfish and your economy, and also how to dig out from under all of that email. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 23rd of October today, and this will be a day, I should tell you, at least for the first couple of minutes of the program, of corporate profits, because it's been a rough week for some venerable names in the American economy. McDonald's and Coke, IBM, all reported very meh kind of results the past couple of days. We mention them because they are the old guard, the blue chips, the companies investors could count on for solid and steady growth. But if solid and steady becomes unpredictable and not so steady, well, then what? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
In the dating pool, blue chips are less bikers who take you to rock shows, more mom's station wagon who gets you home at a reasonable hour. Not edgy or exciting, but they are supposed to be safe. Historically, they were big, well-known companies, says Lawrence White at the NYU Stern School of Business.
Often consumer good companies like Procter & Gamble, like General Motors, like General Electric. Well, lots of generals in there, General Mills.
But White says the idea that blue chips are always safe, well, just remember that GM filed for bankruptcy. And as the market pushed higher and higher in recent years, it wasn't blue chips leading the charge, says Quincy Crosby with Prudential Financial, but she expects them to rebound and hold on to investors.
Even the companies that have been disappointing, they've got cash on their balance sheet. So they're going to try to fix the problem, and they are going to pay investors most likely for waiting while that happens by offering dividends.
Still, blue chips naturally evolve over time, says Joshua Brown, the CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management. Tomorrow's might be a tech stock like Facebook or Chipotle, perhaps Under Armour.
They certainly have blue chip status amongst the younger generation, and if they can continue to execute the way they have, we might very well be looking at the next generation of blue chips. In order for that to happen, some of the older companies have to go away.
Brown thinks McDonald's and Coca-Cola will now hustle to catch up with consumer changes, just like Nike consistently does. He says that's a blue chip with staying power. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Amazon.com isn't quite yet what you would call a blue chip, but we are going to spend a little bit of time talking about that gargantuan online retailer today because it is Amazon. They reported profits after the bell this afternoon. Sales were up, but so too were losses, almost $500 million just in Q3 alone. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He is on that story for us today. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
This is not new from Amazon, right? Selling more stuff, but continuing to lose ever more money.
I know. They're still doing it, man. They're still doing it to us. You know that Wu-Tang song, Cash Rules Everything Around Me?
No, but this go ahead. Hum a few bars. Maybe we'll go for it.
This has to be Jeff Bezos' mantra over the past several years. It describes his past, present, and future, and it cuts both ways, right? He has been trying to make Amazon all about the way that we do commerce online. Mm-hmm. He's been spending a lot of money to do that, but he hasn't been making enough.
So here's what he's got going on, right? He's got this Fire Phone, which has been a complete disaster. He's losing money on streaming video. He's got tablets. He's got Fire TV.
Yes.
I mean, he's throwing everything at the kitchen sink here, or everything at the wall, I suppose, is what you'd say, and nothing seems to be working for him except maybe selling retail.
Well, that is true, selling retail, but also you should remember Amazon's cloud services. He's been trying to expand mm-hmm. in this way. You might remember the U.S. government paid Amazon $600 million for cloud storage for the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
He's been expanding in this area as well as in delivery. You know, this store they're opening up in New York City,
yeah.
Of course, that's part of their same-day delivery service. But yeah, they're not raking it in. He's been doing some exciting things and some boring things, like creating hardware that's similar to all the other hardware that's already out there. I think he's been experimenting, but that's only going to last for so long,
well,
right? He's not making a ton of money.
There comes a time when he has to decide what Amazon is. And I get that we have all been saying there's going to come a time when he has to decide what Amazon is. When
right.
is that time a-coming, man?
It's a hard question to answer because it sure hasn't come so far, right? But he's I hate to try and defend him, but I think he's really thinking about the ecosystem. He's building these pieces of hardware that we can all use and interact with Amazon through. Mm-hmm. He's trying to build media that we buy through Amazon. He's trying to do all these things that basically turn into this giant environment that we can all use and interact with. Now, we should remember there's another environment like this that had an IPO this
right.
year. I think it's called Alibaba.
Yes, it is.
And one of Bezos's big plays, but also one of his big problems, is expanding in the international space, right? He's got a lot of stuff going on in the U.S. He hasn't been able to unlock the possibilities of really expanding in the international scene, and that's a problem.
Talk to me for a second then, and quickly, about why Apple has made the ecosystem work and Jeff Bezos and Amazon has not.
Well, you know, Apple is it's a monolith, right, in many ways. It's like this mm-hmm. company that makes this really effective, innovative hardware and then makes a software suite that works with it. Also, we should think about Google, right?
Right.
Google does Gmail. It does search. It does Android and the Chrome browser. It's all about the web and the way we interact with the web. Amazon's a little more schizophrenic, yeah. you know, and I think that that may be it's part of its problem.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks so much.
You got it, Kai.
On Wall Street today, things were fat, dumb, and happy, baby. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you do business with the American government, especially with, say, the Defense Department, it can be pretty handy to have a security clearance, let you look at the stuff the government considers classified. It can be handy and lucrative, too. At least, it used to be that way, as Nova Sappho reports.
When Don Daniel left his job as special assistant to the chairman of the National Intelligence Council back in 2002, he soon realized his security clearance meant he could have his pick of jobs.
Practically anybody at that time that were working for the intelligence community, you know, when they retired, went to work for a contracting organization. And it made sense because they made more money.
More than 5 to 15% higher salaries compared to other private contractor employees. But then the number of Americans who had security clearances mushroomed, topping 5 million last year.
It's not a unique attribute of an individual to have a secret clearance anymore.
Alan Shvatkin is executive vice president with the Professional Services Council, which advocates for private contractors.
There is less need for paying a premium to those who already have a clearance.
This year, only 37% of private contractors are offering such a premium, down from more than half. That's according to a new survey by data firm Acron, Inc. Its president, Angela Kostopoulos, says the glut of people with clearance is just one factor. He says there's also less demand from the Department of Defense.
Heavy dependence on DOD activity has dropped, and there's a lot more dependence in other types of agencies. It could be agriculture, education.
No need for security clearances for those contracts. But there is one possible wrinkle in the horizon. The U.S. government is reviewing its security clearance process and may tighten it. If that happens and there are delays, those who already have clearances may become more valuable again. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Consider this statistic for just one hot second. Would you, by the end of today worldwide, according to one tech research firm, more than 100 billion with a B work-related emails will have been sent in just this one day alone. Millions of them will likely be ignored. Millions more will have been a precious waste of time because, as any office worker will tell you, we are drowning in email. That is part of why Google is testing a new service. It's called Inbox to help people manage that email beast. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports making email less of a burden has become a high-stakes challenge in the tech industry.
Just how much are we drowning in email? We did an informal poll at Marketplace headquarters.
I have 8,051 unread messages.
It appears to be 1,182.
17,111.
Okay, I know I'm going to get a call from the folks in IT about 10 seconds after this airs. I have 49,493 emails in my inbox.
That gives me major anxiety.
Sharon Profis is a senior editor at CNET and one of those inbox zero types who strive to read and deal with all their email by the end of each day. She says lots of apps have cropped up to help people identify the information they need and filter out the junk. They include Mailbox, Boxer, and now Inbox. But she says there's never going to be one solution.
They all tackle email a little bit differently, and that's the point, because each of us likes to manage our emails differently.
Or not manage them, in my case. One study by McKinsey & Company estimated people spend a quarter of their workdays dealing with email, and that adds up to billions of dollars in lost productivity, says Jonathan Spira, who wrote the book Overload. He says to truly tackle email, you have to change people's habits. One of the best tools he's seen is a prompt that asks, do you really need to copy five people on that message?
That's the type of thing that changes behavior and helps direct emails only to the people who absolutely need to see it.
CNET's Sharon Profis says all of these tools will only work if people are willing to spend time setting them up. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott. Uh-oh, there's the IT department now for Marketplace.
Man, I totally thought that was real. All right, fess up. How many emails do you have sitting in your inbox right now? I've got, you know, some. Tweet us at Marketplace. Coming up.
By 2019, we'll all be enjoying interactive screen sodas that cool your insides with the latest Netflix original series.
I don't even know what that means. One vision of the future of television straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here we go. Shares were up. The Dow Industrials up 216 points, 1.3%, 16,677. The Nasdaq gained 69 points, 1.6%, finished things at 4452. The S&P 500 up 23 points, about 1.25%, 1950. Their Caterpillar crawled up 5% today. The world's biggest construction equipment maker raised its earnings forecast on higher sales of construction machinery here in North America. Still with industrials, 3M gained 4.4% today on strong quarterly earnings. Tractor Supply Company plowed up almost 16% today. The farm supplies retail chain reported higher than estimated earnings and raised its profit forecast. Amazon, we hinted at earlier, down 10% in after-hours trading today. Yelp shrieked down 18.5%, the biggest drop since it went public 2 years ago. The online review company announced yesterday fourth quarter revenue would fall below estimates. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.27%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a look at the housing market. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for September. It's United Nations Day, marking the founding of the organization in 1945. And did you order a Halloween costume online? Because you think ahead? Maybe it was shipped. UPS releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have been running some stories lately about your economy, what literally your economy feels like to you. We've also got a group of small business people that we check in with from time to time with basically the same kind of question. Today, we go to West Central Alabama and a catfish farmer we found down there named Townsend Kaiser of Kaiser Farms. He is in Greensboro, Alabama. Mr. Kaiser, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you again, Kai. How are you today?
I'm all right. How's the catfish business this time of year?
Catfish business is good. We have finished the feeding season and going into a slower time now, so that's nice.
There's a feeding season for catfish? You can't just grow them all the time?
No, sir, you can't. Their bodies slow down and their metabolism slow down when the water cools off.
Oh.
So we have a growing season, and we have to grow enough in 6 months to last the industry the whole year.
Do you have a harvest season, too?
Not really. We harvest year-round. People eat catfish year-round, so we need to harvest and supply the markets with them with fresh fish year-round.
You know, it occurs to me, I have never asked you how much you get per pound or however you sell it when you take catfish to market.
We take catfish to market as a live, whole, fresh fish, and it varies greatly. It has gotten as high as $1.25 a pound and as low as 50 cents a pound.
Where is it right now?
It's about $1.15, and it's stabilized there for the last 2 or 3 years, which has been very, very good for all of us.
Yeah, I bet. Not to ask too personal a question, but how do you like your catfish prepared?
Southern fried is one of the best ways to do it.
Enlighten me. What does that mean?
So you pat the fresh fillets dry and batter them with a little cornmeal and some secret spices and drop them in 350-degree oil for 3 or 4 minutes.
Does when you get out of the general store in Greensboro, what are they talking about these days economy-wise? I mean, are people feeling all right about a recovery or no?
Not great, but it's better than it's been for the last few years. Things seem to be turning around, or at least in our neck of the woods in west central Alabama. It's not the greatest of times, but we've seen worse. I think we're starting to turn around.
Do you have friends who are getting hired on for construction jobs and stuff like that?
Not really. There's not much in our area. The farming drives the economy in our area, and catfish drives that farming. And I have friends in some larger cities who there are more construction jobs, more jobs available, and they are doing better. But as far as rural West Alabama, catfish farming is what drives everything, and it is doing well right now.
When kids get out of high school, right, and they're 18, 19 years old, do they stick around your neck of the woods, or do they take off for Birmingham or New Orleans or someplace else?
They take off for Birmingham or Atlanta.
Yeah. Do they ever come back, or are they gone?
Some do, but most of them are gone.
Huh.
It's kind of sad, but I'm hoping things will turn around and there will be some more jobs available for people in our area. There's a Mercedes plant just north of us that has a lot of good jobs, and it's not too far to drive from here. It's about an hour and a half.
Townsend Kaiser of Kaiser Farms in Greensboro, Alabama. Mr. Kaiser, thanks very much for your time, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, Kai. Thank you.
Vocational high schools, where kids can learn hard skills like welding or plumbing or auto repair, have for years been seen as something of a lesser form of education, siphoning some kids off to do blue-collar work while other kids are encouraged to go off to college and higher income and higher status jobs. Things are, however, changing. Vocational schools are focusing much more now on preparing students for higher education. So today and tomorrow, we're going to take a look at one high school just outside Boston that is redefining what it means to be a vocational school. Emily Hanford has that story.
At Minuteman High School in Lexington, students can learn traditional trades like carpentry, plumbing, and welding. They can also learn video game design, engineering, and biotechnology.
I think I found the heart.
Yeah, the heart is underneath here.
Students wearing white lab coats are dissecting dogfish.
Will we have to cut the liver out?
No.
You have to cut, like...
At Minuteman, students spend half their time in career and technical classes and half their time in academic courses. The school has about 650 students. More than half of them will go to college. This is not the way things were when Principal Ernest Houle went to vocational school back in the 1980s.
The highest level of math I ever had in high school was in Algebra 1, and that only happened my sophomore year because it fit in the schedule.
Houle learned welding, and after high school, he worked for years as a welder.
It wasn't until I went to become a teacher and I realized that not being offered the classes during high school made it more difficult for me when I got into the college arena.
Back then, vocational education wasn't intended to prepare students like Houle for higher education. In fact, the 1917 law that first authorized federal funding for vocational ed in the United States explicitly described it as preparation for occupations not requiring a bachelor's degree.
The early vocational education was driven by a philosophy of fitting people to their probable destinies.
Jim Stone is director of the National Research Center for Career and Technical Education. He says vocational ed was controversial from the start.
Kids from poor communities, poor families, were tracked off into becoming the worker bees.
And when states began judging schools by test scores, it became clear that vocational programs weren't preparing kids academically. To survive, vocational ed had to change, says Dave Ferreira, executive director of the Massachusetts Association of Vocational Administrators.
What we wanted to do was to create a student who was able to go out into the field, but also college ready, a student who could get accepted to a four-year college or university if that's what they wanted to do.
Massachusetts has been especially successful at this. Students at regional vocational high schools do as well on the state English tests as students at traditional high schools, and they do nearly as well on math. And many students and parents say vocational high schools have advantages over traditional high schools because they focus on more than just getting kids to college.
Being an engineer myself, I like the fact that schools like this sort of cater to making an actual living.
Nijan Datar has two sons. They'd been going to private school, but when it was time to choose a high school, Minuteman stood out. This is his son, Sean.
When you think about it, you want to know what you want to do, and you want to be sure of it by the time you go to college, because you don't want to get like $50,000 in debt to like get a major that you're not going to utilize or like you're not even going to enjoy what comes after that.
At Minuteman, Sean is majoring in robotics. His older brother, Brandon, did environmental technology. Now Brandon's at the Colorado School of Mines, working on a bachelor's degree in geological engineering. And listen to what he'd already learned in high school.
Wildlife, wastewater, drinking water, site assessments, geology, hydrogeology, marine science.
By the time he graduated, he had several licenses and certificates. If he'd wanted to get a good job right out of high school, he probably could have. Minuteman graduate Alice Ofria did. Ofria hops out of a truck at the end of a dirt road in Billerica, Massachusetts.
When we do the samples, we get them directly from the main, so we usually open a hydrant here.
Ofria's a lab technician for the town's drinking water department, a job she got because of an internship through Minuteman. On this rainy spring day, she's collecting water samples, and she's making nearly $28 an hour.
Most of my friends are like waitresses or work at like as a secretary somewhere, at like a tanning salon, stuff like that.
But Ofria, who's now 23, just bought a new truck and went on a vacation to Puerto Rico. And that $28 an hour job, it helped a lot when it came to college tuition. She just graduated from UMass Boston with a bachelor's degree in environmental science.
Vocational school is where it's at, to put it bluntly.
Some politicians and advocates for low-income students are skeptical. They worry vocational ed is still tracking too many kids to work rather than college. But here's the thing. A lot of kids don't want to go to college. We'll have more on that tomorrow. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
Emily's story is part of an hour-long documentary about vocational education. It's produced by American Radio Works. You can find a link to it at our website. It's marketplace.org. We've been spending some time the past month or so on television, how it's changing with changes in technology and in our viewing habits. Our series is called Screen Wars. But here's the thing. At some point, one does have to wonder whether this whole screen thing has gone far enough, because you can only watch in so many different ways, right? Daniel Kibblesmith and Sam Weiner, the authors of How to Win at Everything, say au contraire.
We all know that by 2015, every American will own a touchscreen refrigerator, two smartwatches, and virtual reality goggles that replace your family and friends with characters from your favorite TV shows.
But in the future, we'll be even more surrounded by helpful, distracting screens.
By 2016, your car's windshield will be a flexible LED display that blocks out your boring commute with a grid of 25 music videos playing simultaneously.
And forget Google Glass. By 2017, everyone in the world will be wearing hip, computerized contact lenses.
Because they'll be mandatory.
With these convenient, painful surgical implants, you'll never miss another text message, status update, or non-skippable advertisement. Because you'll still see them even when you close your eyes.
Soon, you'll be able to scroll through hundreds of vacation photos just by swiping your finger across your cornea.
By 2019, we'll all be enjoying interactive screen sodas that cool your insides with the latest Netflix original series.
By 2020, even the money in your wallet will be made of screens. You'll be able to put your own face on the $20 bill, in between displaying even more non-skippable advertisements.
But the future of the screen doesn't end there.
It ends 10 years from now.
When every human on the planet will be safely ensconced in their own full-body screen suits.
It'll place you in a virtual environment so indistinguishable from reality that there's no way of proving you're not inside of one right now.
Great point, Sam. Who's to say that everything you've ever seen on a screen hasn't been a simulation inside of a larger screen that's quietly replaced our own reality?
Regardless of whether we exist or not, the future of the screen is looking bright.
Daniel Kibblesmith and Sam Weiner are the authors of How to Win at Everything. We, of course, have all of our series, Screen Wars, online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I would humbly offer, is an early indication that data journalism, the latest iteration of news in our society, may, just may, be jumping the shark. From the real estate brokerage firm Redfin, a calculation of residential toilets per capita in the country's biggest metropolitan areas, Boulder, Colorado is the winner, I guess you would say. 102 commodes per 100 people. That is more than one apiece. Miami, Florida comes up last, 62 per 100. National average, should you be curious? 83 Johns for every 100 of us. Yes, a useful thing for urban planners and maybe city officials to know about, but still, right? Okay, that's it. We got to go. The Dow up 216 points today, about 1.3%. The NASDAQ climbed 69 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 rose 23 points, 1.25%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.